Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, as part of our ongoing series looking at food waste, we'll take a look at how the city of Boulder has its own goals of diverting 85% of the city's waste from landfills by the year 2025. They did hit a milestone this year, but how far is left to go? We'll get more coming up after headlines. Then we'll hear about a new documentary on overcoming white supremacy that's airing on Rocky Mountain PBS this week. It's produced by Susan Polis Schutz, who is the mother of the governor of Colorado. We'll speak with Susan about her new documentary, Love Wins Over Hate. Then we'll hear about the Orchard Restoration Project in Montezuma, Colorado, about their quest to return a long-lost apple to Colorado consumers. After headlines from the BBC at the bottom of the hour, we'll have a new commentary from Jim Hightower. Then the Community Foundation of Boulder County is your host for a public affair. At 9 o'clock, as always on Mondays, we'll have media analysis from Counterspin rounding out this morning's news on public affairs. Then Leland is in for the Morning Send Alternative, bringing us a great morning of music. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
The winter storm that came into the state yesterday has given firefighters a much-needed reprieve. However, officials said that while the snow has calmed the East Troublesome and Cameron Peak wildfires, it has not extinguished them. Closer to Boulder, up to 11 inches of snow fell over the Calwood fire yesterday, according to the official Facebook page for it and the Left Hand Canyon fire. Freezing drizzle and treacherous roads made travel extremely dangerous. Firefighters took the day to fix equipment and will be ready to go if conditions allow. The Calwood fire is 76% contained and has burned 10,105 acres. The Left Hand Canyon fire is 100% contained at 460 acres. As far as the East Troublesome and Cameron Peak fires are concerned, Paul Delmerico, operations section chief on both the fire zones near Estes Park, said that they did not anticipate any growth yesterday or today, adding that it will likely be a few days before they see fire activity in the area. But Saturday was different. Rocky Mountain Park officials reported that the East Troublesome fire intensified and continued to make a significant eastward run from the Continental Divide to Bear Lake Road on the east side. Nine News reports that officials estimate as many as 300 to 400 homes have been burned in the East Troublesome fire. Crews are still assessing damage, but the homes belonging to at least seven fire personnel are complete losses. Brett Schrettline, or the Grand County Sheriff, said that all missing people have been located and no one is unaccounted for as of Sunday. However, he cautioned that the fire is not over and that the disaster continues. Aurora Mayor Mike Kaufman said yesterday that he tested positive for COVID-19 and will quarantine until he is free of the virus. The Denver Post reports that the news prompted Governor Jared Polis, who was with Kaufman on October 15th, to consider quarantining, but state health officials determined he did not need to do so because there was no risk to the governor of being exposed from the mayor. Mayor Kaufman said on Twitter that he did not feel well on Thursday with a very mild cold and cough. A rapid test Saturday was positive. The mayor's results come as coronavirus cases are on the rise in Colorado, including Aurora. On Friday, the Tri-County Health Department announced it was increasing restrictions on businesses and residents, moving Adams County from a level 2 alert to a level 3 because of skyrocketing cases. Also on Friday, Colorado health officials issued an order limiting gatherings in the state to no more than 10 people, and those are limited to persons from only two separate households. The order goes into effect immediately and lasts for at least 30 days. The Colorado Sun reports that residents were previously allowed to gather in groups of up to 25 people with no limit on how many households they could come from. Under the new order, there is no limit on gatherings of members of the same household, but people must postpone, at least for the time being, gathering in parks, backyards, or indoors with a few other couples to socialize. Dr. Rachel Herlihy, Colorado's top epidemiologist, has warned that if the trend in new cases is not reversed, the state's intensive care hospital bed capacity could be surpassed in the coming months. University of Colorado Boulder officials announced Friday that there will not be a traditional spring break next semester. Not having the vacation is an effort to prevent a surge in cases similar to what happened this fall. The Daily Camera reports that Chief Operations Officer Pat O'Rourke said that students traveling for spring break could be very taxing on mental health if they were to spread the virus and cause a spike. Students are not returning to campus after Thanksgiving in November and will finish the semester through all remote learning. The spring semester will begin January 14th, 3 days later than normal, and the campus will have two additional midweek wellness days. Denver's South High School is adopting a new mascot and will now be known as the home of the Ravens. Denver 7 reports that the change replaces the Rebels, which harkens back to the days of the Confederacy. Bobby Thomas, the principal of South, said in a statement that the old emblem no longer seemed appropriate, acceptable, or accurate for what South High stands for. Denver Public Schools board member Tay Anderson applauded the decision, saying he hopes other schools will take note. The weather is affecting many schools and offices in the metro area. All St. Vrain Valley District classes are canceled Monday, including both in-person and virtual classes. In the Boulder Valley School District, students learn independently on Mondays to give teachers time to plan, but Boulder Valley will have a two-hour delay for its child care programs. Aurora Public Schools are closed, as are those in Jefferson County. In Denver, all public schools will be on remote learning. CU Boulder is on a two-hour delay. The snow may continue until about 11 this morning. Then it will be mostly cloudy with a high of only 16 and wind chill values making it feel close to zero. Tonight, the low will be around 5 and tomorrow sunny with highs near 40 and the warming continuing into Wednesday with the high around 50. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, in 2005, the year 2005, Boulder set a goal of diverting 85% of the city's waste from landfills by the year 2025. Well, we've got 5 years left to reach that goal. As part of our year-long look at food waste, Sarah Dugleish brings us this report.
Up to 90% of items that end up in the Boulder landfill could be recycled or composted. Chances are, you've used the three-bin system of compost recycling and landfill receptacles around Boulder. This initiative is only part of Zero Waste Boulder's effort to reduce the city's waste. Kara Mertz is the sustainability director for the city. She says Boulder still has a ways to go to get to its 2025 goal.
In 2005, the city set a goal of 85% waste diversion, which is essentially zero waste. We feel like if we could get to a place where we're only throwing out 10 to 15% of the materials that come into our homes and businesses, then we're doing pretty well. Especially in the times of COVID and the associated recent increase in single-use plastics and disposable packaging, it really is a challenge for us. And we do have a ways to go to get there, but I don't feel like it's impossible for us to get there. It does mean that what we want to do is to try and create opportunities for reuse and minimizing waste before it happens. And so we are refocusing some of our efforts in that realm.
COVID-19 has not only caused major shifts in food systems, but has also increased the amount of waste associated with food, especially as more items are individually wrapped and takeout has become a popular option. Zero Waste Boulder is working towards solutions to reduce and divert the waste created by these situations.
One of the things that we've really been refocusing on is how do we create systems so that the easiest, cheapest, most convenient option is the most environmentally sensitive option. We just started a program for restaurants so that they can get subsidized compostable and reusable takeout containers. The burden shouldn't always be on the consumer's shoulders to make the right choice. It really should be, ideally, that we're setting the systems up and we as local government are working with state and federal governments and working with corporations to make it so that what ends up in the hands of our local consumers is the right, easy to manage choice.
Mertz says the ability of the local government, corporations, and nonprofits to reduce waste collaboratively is one of the things that has most helped Boulder move towards its goal.
We have a really interesting environment here in Boulder, very different than other parts of the country. We have the city programs, but then we also have nonprofits and for-profit companies that add to the network of service providers. We really do rely on this tightly knit network of governmental, for-profit, and nonprofit organizations to deliver the programs and services that we have. So it really is kind of a quilt woven together of service providers that have various roles and various value propositions that we all try to coordinate and work together to make sure that we can provide services to the community equitably.
When it comes to reducing waste, decreasing the amount of goods we consume actually has a greater impact on lowering emissions than driving less or using less energy at home.
When you look at the emissions associated with how much we consume in Boulder and everywhere, really, it's kind of astounding. We did a study that found that the emissions associated with how much stuff we use and consume far outweighs the emissions associated with local use of electricity, transportation, and statistically, a 5% reduction in the amount of stuff we use as individuals equates to a 10% reduction in the amount of electricity we use.
In this regard, the public can play a large role in helping Boulder achieve its goal. Mertz says support from the community is what has allowed the zero waste effort to progress this far.
The best thing we have here, honestly, is an engaged community. And that's not just the residents, but it's also committed for-profit businesses and nonprofit organizations. The reason Boulder is able to do this is because our programs are consistently supported by our community. Organizations like EcoCycle get volunteers and advocates out to council meetings so that our elected officials feel like we have their backs and that when they pass sweeping legislation, they feel supported by the community. Before we put the Universal Zero Waste Ordinance into effect, we had focus groups with community members. And what we heard consistently was that businesses support zero waste, their employees ask for zero waste, students ask for it at their university and at their K through 12 schools. And the best thing that other communities could do to replicate what we're doing here is really to organize community members. It really does come down to everyone playing their part.
For KGNU, I'm Sarah Dalgleish.
You can find our full series on food waste, including tips on how we can reduce food waste as consumers by changing how we shop or changing our attitude to some of the foods that we use. Weekly tips by John Lendorf. It's all online at news.kgnu.org. Well, Susan Polis-Schutz is a documentary filmmaker whose latest documentary is Love Wins Over Hate, which uncovers the origins and complexities of hatred in the United States. It's currently being screened on public television channels around the country.
Every morning we wake up and we have coffee and we watch the news. And then I scroll through some social media. And the hatred and anger and divisiveness, it just kept every morning, and all day, all week, all month. That's primarily what's on the news and what's happening. And it's very, very sad and confusing. Our world is just being ruined. So I was wondering, why do people hate? What's behind the hate? I mean, are they that miserable that they take their hatred out on everything and everybody? But even so, why are they so vitriolic and why don't they accept people? And then I wondered if people that hate so much can change. So those were the questions I had. And then I read, then I decided, let me understand people that hate. And I interviewed on the phone people that I found out were prejudiced against various people and or hated groups. And they didn't think they were prejudiced. They didn't think they were hateful, and they thought I was the one. So I figured, well, that's definitely not, you know, the right route to go for a movie. And then I read an article about a former violent white supremacist who left the movement, and he completely changed and actually went from prejudice to acceptance, anger to serenity, hate to love. And now he just goes around helping people all over the world, actually, change. So that was kind of what happened. And then I wanted to know more, and I interviewed more and more people, and I wanted to see if there were any common threads among them so we could learn lessons from it.
Well, in addition to folks who are on, I mean, we might say the wrong side of hatred, the ones who are the white supremacists, the ones who are putting forth that anger and that hatred, you also talk with the victims of violence as a result of that hatred. And, you know, you have their voices included as well. What was the commonality then? Because it does seem very hard to get our heads around why people hate others because of their sexual orientation, their gender identity, the colour of their skin, their race. And yet this is what we're dealing with right now. Were you able to see the humanity in those folks? Granted, you were talking to people who had recognized how detrimental their former hatred was. But, you know, what did you see in terms of the humanity of that can maybe help us understand why there is that kind of hate?
Yeah. And so, OK, so, and they weren't all white supremacist ones. I interviewed, for instance, Tim Turek, who grew up in a family who hated gay people. They thought they were sinners. So he wasn't a white extremist. He just had learned that kind of thought pattern. But so what the common threads were, almost all of them came from some kind of dysfunctional family, whether it be alcohol or physical or mental abuse. Almost all of them were bullied at one time or another. They didn't fit in. They had no self-esteem. And then after they either graduated from school or once they were out of their parents' homes, white supremacists tend to look for and attract people that are vulnerable. And so they met each one of these people and said, geez, you know, we're a family, come join us, and you're really smart, and you can move up in the organization. And so they kept after them, and then these people joined the group, and it was like their family, their community. And for the first time in their lives, they had a family that loved them, well, supposedly loved them. And many of them did not even have prejudices before they went in. They were taught the prejudices. So that was a real common characteristic that occurred with every single one that was in a white supremacist group.
From what you've learned from doing this film and from the interviews that you've done, the people that you've met, and it's really extensive, do you get a sense of what we need to do or what we can do as a society when we see hate? And all of this, of course, in the context that so much of this hate is coming from the highest office in the land right now. You know, we're weeks away from the election. That could change. But where do we go as a society, you know, with the lessons that you've learned from making this film?
Well, you know, excuse me, just like you said, it has, a lot of it has to come from our leaders. And a lot of it has to come from people approaching people. So one of the things I found out was that some of the people that were prejudiced against, for instance, Muslims, they had never met a Muslim. Let me see, who was it? Arno McAllis. He now has a group that helps people get out of the supremacist group and helps to make the change. His friend, Pardeep Kalika, I think it was his father and his brother, were killed in an attack on Muslims. And he and Arno and Pardeep teamed up and they go around and they try and introduce people to the quote prejudiced people who have never met the people that they're prejudiced against. I'm not saying that very well, but so one thing is connection. Everyone wants to be connected to someone. So it's so important to meet these people that you think you hate, but you don't even know them. You know, one of I think Shannon Martinez said, you sit down with them and have a meal with them and you find out you're all the same. Everybody wants the same things. Everybody is one. They want love, health, family. They want to earn a living. And then they want to have a connection with something greater than themselves. So I think people have to do this on an individual basis, but be inspired by the leaders to do this.
It was great to see Colorado voices heard and represented in the movie, and particularly the part of the movie where you feature people who are parts of, you know, who are members of groups who are themselves victimized. You know, and one of them really struck me with Nicole Garcia, a regular voice on KGNU, transgender woman. In fact, the first transgender person of color who's to serve as a minister of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. We had Nicole on when she made history in that regard. And, you know, when you hear directly from people and you realize that people are human and you take away the capacity to other people, to, you know, as we are seeing from Donald Trump when he describes people as animals or, you know, dehumanizing language, that seems to be the key to move forward, that we have to recognize the humanity in people.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you have to have empathy towards everyone. Those, you know, I put that section in because I don't think people realize how hurtful it is to be prejudiced against or to be bullied, and I wanted to get across. I mean, I could have just done a whole film on victims, but I wanted to explain more of the whole idea. But every one of them suffered. I mean, suffered greatly. And you know, as some of them said, they went on to do great things because of that. But others that maybe not as strong really cave in and never have any self-esteem.
That's Susan Polis-Schutz, who is the producer of this new documentary, Love Wins Over Hate, that takes a look at the personal transformation of six people who went from agents of anger and bigotry to advocates for empathy and inclusivity. She is also the mother of Colorado Governor Jared Polis, and she says Jared Polis loves the documentary. And in fact, it's going to be screened this Thursday, October 29th at 8 p.m. on Rocky Mountain PBS, RMPBS. You can catch Love Wins Over Hate at 8 p.m. It is 8:26. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. Well, a varietal of apple, long thought to be extinct, is coming back to life in Colorado, thanks to a couple in Montezuma County. KSUT's Mark Dugan has more.
Eddie and Jude Schettemeyer run the Montezuma Orchard Restoration Project. Their mission is to preserve Colorado's apple-growing legacy. They do this by building a repository of apple genetics and reintroducing old varieties to consumers. One type of apple had eluded them for years, the Colorado orange. It was popular more than a century ago, but it had fallen out of favor and was believed to be extinct. Their search led them to a grower in Canyon City, Colorado. He invited the Schettemeyers to take a cutting from an unusual tree in his orchard that he felt was a Colorado orange. It took a couple more years of research, using old watercolors and wax apple models. But finally, recently, Addie and Jude Schettemeyer successfully identified that cutting as the long-lost Colorado orange. What's so special about it? It has the power to make some people remember it 80 years after first tasting it. When I interviewed Jude Schettemeyer recently, he mentioned that a few years back, the man in Canyon City had provided some apples from that unusual tree to a local event.
They did the Heritage Apple tasting, and folks that were in their 80s and 90s back then saw Paul's apple and said, yes, it's a Colorado orange.
They remembered an apple they hadn't tasted since they were children.
Yes, we see that here too, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong.
Jude, what does the Colorado orange taste like?
It's got a bit of an acidity zing to a little bit of a sub-acidity. It has a little bit of a citrusy kind of flavor to it. This is one of these apples where it's a fairly complex, has a little bit of sweet to it, but has some tang to it, but it has a real kind of pleasant, rounded flavor to it, too.
Why did such an apparently popular and flavorful apple such as the Colorado Orange die out?
The Colorado Orange, the thing it had against it was that it was a yellowish-orangish apple that could sometimes be red. At a time when America was moving away from this great diversity of cultivar varieties, of number of apple varieties, by the early 1900s, all of that explosion of varieties, these tens of thousands, up to 17,000, 18,000 varieties of apples, started to decrease. People lived further away from the farms in cities. They weren't farming, so they were relying on transportation systems and larger growers growing less varieties to ship further away. And in America, most people like the red apple.
Jude, what's next for the Colorado Orange? I know you're open about wanting to see this apple eventually return to grocery stores and farmers markets and restaurants. How does that process work?
Absolutely. That's the big goal, is that people will be able to get it back again. Our big goal is to get this out to as many people as we can. We tried to get it out to the people that we best thought were going to be able to share it with more people the quickest. We're really hoping that this way of getting the material out to the best grafters we know and people that we know will turn around and share it is going to be able to get it out to people. I hope within 5 years, hopefully under 10, those things will be on store shelves in Colorado.
Apples are obviously your labor of love. Why is their genetic diversity so important, and what role do they play in other items in the food chain and even in what we put on the dinner table?
People don't realize this, but Colorado used to produce way more apples than it did peaches. It was a big producer of apples. Apples especially, and this is true of peaches too, but they grow better here. There's a combination of hot sunny days, cool nights that allow flavors to sit. They allow the sugars to become more complex. The sun allows the fruit to get more beautiful. We really feel like there is a way forward of having orchards being a part of our future, just as they were a foundational part of our past. This grant we just announced, that we got the local food promotion grant. We got the grant to get the mobile cider press for down here. Now we'll have the ability to process the apples and take something that was just a lost crop and turn it into hopefully a $1 million industry here within the next 10 years or so.
That's Jude Schoenemeyer. He and his wife Addie run the Montezuma Orchard Restoration Project, also known as MORP, from McElmo Canyon, southwest of Cortez. Reporting for KSUT, I'm Mark Dugan.